October 1868 and December 1869. That's in the left-hand column. He submitted this version of his opera to the director of the Imperial Theatres in St. Petersburg in the spring of 1870. In February of the following year, the selection committee rejected the work, citing principally the lack of a major role for soprano, and criticizing Mussorgsky's omission from Pushkin's drama of the love interest between Marina Mnishek and the false Dmitri, the subject of the newly added Polish opera. Mussorgsky's revision, eagerly undertaken and completed in late June 1872, evolved into a reconception of the opera, now incorporating more historical background material from the works of Nikolai Mikhailovich Karamzin. This definitive version of the work, on the right-hand column of the page, was cast in the form of 9 scenes divided into a prologue and 4 acts. 6 scenes from the initial version were altered to varying degrees, and 3 scenes were recomposed. The St. Basil scene was eliminated. Of the 6 scenes retained from the original version, 3 were revised simply by eliminating musical material rather than rewriting. The remaining 3 scenes were more extensively revised, and the Terum Act in the Tsar's Apartments, Act 2 as we now know it, was thoroughly recomposed. The new scenes are those 2 of the Polish Act, incorporating the requested material from Pushkin, and a final scene set in the forest outside Komi, known as the Revolution Scene, now placed after the death of Boris. This scene was exchanged for the St. Basil scene, which opened the final act in the initial version, and incorporates 2 sections from that original scene, the episode involving the Holy Fool and the urchins who steal his puppet, and the Fool's Lament for the Fate of Russia, which originally closed the St. Basil scene, and which now ends the opera. A vocal score of this new edition was published by Bessel in January 1874. Boris Godunov has had a peculiar performance history, beginning with the first staging of any of the music from the opera, when Edward the Prophet conducted the in scene and the 2 scenes of the Polish act at the Mariinsky Theatre, St. Petersburg, in February of 1873. None of these scenes involves the title character, and they were given on a program which also included the second act of Lohengrin and the first scene of the second act of Der Freischutz. The bonus scenes were enormously successful, reviews were very enthusiastic, and most critics went out of their way to praise Mussorgsky's orchestration. The first full performance, more or less, occurred also at the Mariinsky Theatre, again conducted by Napravnik. 1 year later, in February 1874, at which time the scene at the monastery was omitted, and there were additional cuts to the second, third, and fourth acts. Incidentally, the first performance of Mussorgsky's initial version of the opera did not occur until February of 1928 in Leningrad, following publication of the work in the edition by Pavel Lan, more of which later. No discussion of Boris Godunov could be complete without invoking the name Nikolai Andreevich Rimsky-Korsakov. In 1896, 15 years after Mussorgsky's death, Rimsky-Korsakov prepared and published an edition of Boris based on the composer's printed vocal score of 1874, but heavily cut, reorchestrated, and drastically reworked. The order of Mussorgsky's final. This new version was staged for the first time in the now legendary production by Serge Diaghilev at the Paris Opera in May 1908, with Fyodor Shalyapin in the title role. For this production, Rimsky further expanded the coronation scene. This edition was published in vocal score, also by Bessel, in 1908. If one were to compare Mussorgsky's 1874 vocal score, his definitive edition, with Rimsky's 1908 edition, that is, setting aside completely the matter of orchestration, of the 4,245 measures in Rimsky's score, only 665 were transferred from Mussorgsky's score without change. And this is just notes we're talking about, not orchestration. An additional 152 measures of Mussorgsky's score were cut altogether. Although in his preface, Rimsky states, quote, "This edition of Mussorgsky's music drama is issued in its entirety without any cuts whatsoever. Rimsky complained of Mussorgsky's, quote, almost exclusively string band orchestration, and likened it to an imitation of Louis XIV's Vingt-quatre Violons du Roi. Interestingly, César Cui also viewed Mussorgsky's orchestration as period imitation. In broad terms, Mussorgsky's basic sonority is string-based, whereas Rimsky's orchestration is wind and brass-based. Here are two passages contrasting the Mussorgsky and Rimsky scores. The first is the march, which accompanies the false Dmitri's entrance in the Chromy Forest scene. It is punctuated with a striking flourish of the violins, a descending ascending line in 16th notes, descending in second violins, ascending in the firsts, which, with the two violin sections seated antiphonally as they would have been, creates a striking wash of music across the stage from audience right to left. Here's the passage first in Mussorgsky's orchestration. And now the same passage from Rimsky's score. Next, from Mussorgsky's 1874 score, is the end of the Polish act, the fountain scene, beginning with the orchestral peroration which concludes the Marina Dmitri duet. Together, they sing a few additional phrases, and the third voice you'll hear is that of the Jesuit Rangoni, who is the motivation behind Marina's ambition at this point in the drama. Note not only the basic string sonority of Mussorgsky's score, but also the sinuous descending chromatic line given to the oboe and what becomes of it in Rimsky's orchestration. First, the passage from Mussorgsky. And now the same music from Rimsky's score. Thank you. is but one striking illustration of the extent of Rimsky's revisions. Rimsky's definitive 19-8 score has been recorded only once in its entirety without cuts, the recording listed as number 9 on my discography, connected by André Cloyton with the Paris and Sophia forces, featuring Boris Christoff in the title role. Christoff also sings the roles of Pimen and Varlam, as he had on a previous EMI recording from 1952, connected by Issei Dobrovin, which incidentally was Nikolai Geda's very first recording, which was also Rimsky's 1980 score, but with the monastery scene and the second scene of the Polish Act drawn from Rimsky's 1896 edition. Rimsky's controversial changes were quickly challenged by other musicians. In the 1920s, Emil Milngailis orchestrated the opera from the first edition of Mussorgsky's vocal score for performances at Riga. At about the same time, Eugene Goossens orchestrated excerpts from the 1874 score for a film version. Then in 1928, Soviet musicologist Pavel Lam produced an edition of Boris Godunov, which presented both the initial and revised versions of the opera. Lam's edition, part of the first collected works edition of the composer, is a conflated score, incorporating what he called the preliminary score of 1869 into the definitive score of 1872. This is what Richard Taruskin so aptly refers to as the supersaturated text. In broad terms, Lam's score retains the composer's revisions, but reinstates his cuts. Material discarded by Mussorgsky in the course of his revisions is relegated to the score's footnotes and critical apparatus. The Terem Act, Act II, so drastically revised by the composer, is given twice in Lam's edition, both in its original and definitive forms. Working from this score, Dmitri Shostakovich prepared a new orchestration in 1939-40, first performed at the Kirov Opera in 1959. And in 1953, Polish composer Karol Rathaus touched up Mussorgsky Lam for a new production at the Metropolitan Opera by Mstislav Dobrzyński, with sets culled from his productions of Khovanshina and Bunbalo and Maskera. In 1998, Valery Gergiev conducted performances at the Met in an orchestration by Igor Buketov. For the opera's centenary in 1874, Oxford University Press published a new critical edition prepared by David Lloyd-Jones, which follows Lam's model in conflating Mussorgsky's two scores, an edition which has since formed the basis of many stage productions and most recordings of the opera. Prior to 1976, it was not possible to hear Mussorgsky's opera in his own orchestration on recordings. Rimsky-Korsakov's edition remained in use, beginning with the first complete recording from the Bolshoi Opera in 1948, conducted by Nikolai Golovanov. I've already cited Pluton's performance as being the only uncut recording of Rimsky's definitive 1908 edition. For a production at the Bolshoi Theater in 1925, Mikhail Ippolitov Ivanov was commissioned to orchestrate the St. Basil scene in the style of Rimsky for inclusion in a 10-scene production of the opera. His orchestration for this scene has remained in use in the context of the Rimsky score, and is preserved on several recordings. I have cited Herbert von Karajan's recording, number 10, as an example of this practice. It is one of only three recordings of the uncut 1908 Rimsky score to include the St. Basil scene in Ippolitov Ivanov's orchestration, the other two being Mark Erler's Bolshoi recording with Yevgeny Nestorenko and the Sofia Opera recording with Nikolai Gusilev as Boris. Also worth noting is a performing edition which remained in use at the Bolshoi Opera from 1948 to the mid-1970s, representing a stable conflation first produced in Moscow in 1927, exemplified by the recording number 11, conducted by Alexander Melik-Pashayev with George London in the title role. This is Rimsky's 1908 edition, augmented by Ippolitov Ivanov's orchestration of the St. Basil scene, but reverting to Rimsky's 1896 score for the Trudov Monastery scene and the second scene of the Polish Act. The Terem scene is given in a version which restores some, but not all, of Rimsky's cuts from his 1896 edition, and is in all other recordings which include the Ippolitov-Ivanov orchestration of the St. Basil scene. The episode involving the Holy Fool and the boys is cut from the Chromy Forest scene having already been heard in the now restored St. Basil scene. Jerzy Semko's recording from BMI in 1976 was the first to present the complete opera in Mussorgsky's orchestration. The first four recordings, as did my discography, include all 10 scenes from the opera in the conflation drawn from David Lloyd Jones's edition, that is, into Ruskin's supersaturated text, the revisions of 1872 incorporating the passages cut from 1869. Next to each listing, I have quoted the publisher's erroneous descriptions of what these recordings present. Each of these first four performances, conducted by Semplov, Claudio Abbado, Mstislav Rostropovich, and Emil Chakarov, in turn present differing texts. Semplov and Abbado both remove the episode involving the Holy Fool from the Chromy Forest scene, while Rostropovich and Chakarov include it, despite the fact it is previously heard in the St. Basil scene. Abbado cuts the fool's lament from the final pages of the St. Basil scene so that it concludes only the scene at Chromy. Rostropovich and Semkov include a short passage in the second act which is found only in manuscript. Abbado and Chakarov do not. Vladimir Fedoseyev's recording, number 5, made between 1978 and 1983, surely a testimony to Soviet-era efficiency, is based on the definitive edition of 1872 only inasmuch as it follows the 9-scene outline of the 1872 score. The St. Basil scene is omitted, but the remaining scenes are given in full conflation. Dmitry Katenko's recording, number 6, tantalizingly offers a version based on the 1868-69 version, but in fact contains only 6 of the opera's original 7 scenes, omitting St. Basil's, with only the prologue given in pure 1869 form. The rest is cut and conflated. But ironically, it offers the first recording of the pure 1872 version of the monastery scene, this in the context of a version of the work with forces from the Kirov opera. When I first learned of this venture, I thought, at last we have reached the Pacific. Philips publicity showcased the presentation of the opera in 2 versions. The discs are even color-coded so one does not confuse one version with the other. But neither recording presents either version of the opera. They are both conflations. One recording presents all but the monastery scene in Mussorgsky's 1869 version. The monastery scene is essentially that of 1872, but with earlier additions. In Gergiev's 1872 version, only the monastery scene and the newly composed scenes are heard in their 1872 forms. The remainder are given in conflation. The principal value of Philip's release is the first recording without alterations of the initial version of the second act. Before any complete original orchestration recordings appeared, there had been 2 attempts to record the initial version of the second act, both on the Melodia label. But in the first, Boris's monologue was given in the 1872 revision, and in the second, in Dmitri Shostakovich's orchestration, Shuishkin's narrative was heard in the 1872 revision. So we still await a recording of Boris Godunov in either of the versions Mussorgsky knew or would recognize. Why is this so hard to achieve? Whenever Mussorgsky added to his score, he took something away. The St. Basil scene, for example, the most often included adjustment in any conflation, contains one of the most powerful episodes in the opera, the confrontation between the Holy Fool and the Tsar. In transferring this scene to the Chromy Forest, Mussorgsky was only able to transfer the first half of it, in which a group of street urchins steal the fool's only kopeck, which is a setup for the confrontation with Boris, which in the Chromy Forest does not occur. So this sequence is much less effective in its new context. The restoration of the St. Basil scene, even in an orchestration other than the composer's or Rimsky's, is hard to resist. Indeed, a persuasive argument can be made for the restoration of most, if not all, of the passages Mussorgsky deleted from his original score in the course of making revisions. In preparing a text for performance, there are many passages. The concluding choral scene after the exit of the blind pilgrims in the prologue, the surfeit of domesticity, which starts the second act, the new second act. The second somewhat repetitive duet for Rangoni and Dmitri in the Polish act. All of these are easily sacrificed in order to retain something as powerful as the same Basel scene. And therein lies the dilemma. The conflated, even pruned text makes for a musically richer and dramatically more compelling evening in the theater than either of Mussorgsky's versions taken on its own. And one also has to keep in mind that the David Lloyd Jones score, which still is the authoritative score, is in itself a conflation, which makes it difficult and time-consuming for producers, directors, conductors to take the piece apart. In the mid-1980s, PBS broadcast a nature series called The Wild World of Animals. Among the more unusual programs was one called In Search of the Hammerhead Shark. Evidently, the hammerhead shark is an elusive creature. During the course of this expedition, scientists and oceanographers introduced us to a variety of underwater fauna. But this episode proved unique to the series in that by its end, they hadn't found any hammerhead shark. They are, in fact, now all on CD, yes.
Okay. I guess that you mentioned earlier the Nikolai Golovanov recording. I guess you lack of inclusion of it here. Is it because it's not available on CD?
It is available. This is not all the recordings that are available. These are all the original, quote, original orchestration recordings that are available, and then just a representative of each of these other texts that I talked about. And, you know, truth be told, Zemko does, in fact, play Mussorgsky's orchestration. All the other conductors tweak it a little bit. But not, I mean, Rimsky-Korsakov was the king of the tweakers. Yes?
As I recall, I haven't listened to it in several years, I think since it came out, in fact, but in the Gergiev recording of the 1869 version, I think there's some other problems that, other than in addition to the ones that you mentioned, in places where the music, Mussorgsky's music is essentially the same in 1872 as it is in 1869. Nonetheless, he makes 1, 2, 3 bar revisions here and there, and Gergiev took them from 72 the alleged 1869 version.
Yes. And he uses, for example, at the beginning of the in scene, he uses the orchestral introduction from 1869 in the 1872 recording. San Francisco Opera did the 1869, claimed to be doing the 1869 version of the opera last October, and I went out there to see it. And they did pretty much they did the seven scenes. In the Churov Monastery scene, they restored the offstage choruses from 1872, and Pimen's description of the murder at Bublish was there. And they restored the hostess's song to the duck in the scene. But apart from that, it was 1869.
What scores are available of the original untouched versions? Anything?
Well, there's a new edition of the Mussorgsky works coming out, and the first volume of that is the 1879 score, and I think it's out already. And when they get to 1872, they will issue that separately. So for the first time, there will be scores for each one of these things, which won't stop conductors from, you know, knitting it back together. But nevertheless, you'll be able to see clearly one from the other, which is part of the problem here too. But there are other disadvantages too. There are things you lose either way.
Yes. I found it interesting when the Met did Igor Buketov's orchestration because Buketov.
Did you like it?
No, I didn't say I liked it. Buketov guest conducted at our school about 25 years ago, and I also sang with him at Saratoga in the Saratoga Potsdam Chorus for Philadelphia Orchestra, I think in 1983. At any rate, when he was at our school around 1984, he told me that he had for a long time, had been an advocate for Mussorgsky's quote-unquote originals, but that he had come to believe that Rimsky had actually helped Mussorgsky. But sometime between 1984 and the time the Met, did his version, he obviously had second thoughts and decided that some other kind of help was needed, and I find that interesting. And I of course had no further contact with him and never got a chance to discuss it with him again.
I heard the Rimsky score once performed by a touring company, and it was a revelation to me because I realized for the first time the advantages to making the piece sound with the Rimsky orchestration, how much easier it would be for not highly skilled players, or even amateur players, as there probably were in small houses in Russia and in Europe, at the turn of the last century, that it was probably just a lot easier to get the piece to work in the Rimsky, because the Mussorgsky orchestration is difficult to make work. It's wonderful when it happens, but if you're short on time, you don't have the most highly skilled players, the Rimsky does help in that regard.
Yeah, and sort of related to that, maybe you can confirm or deny this. I have read that when the Met revived one of the original versions back in the 1970s, I believe.
Shepard was the first.
I never heard them, but I have read that they still found that some of the orchestration problems, the balance problems, could not be solved. At least they were unable to solve them.
Right.
And so there are portions of it that, where they resorted to the Carl Rathaus orchestration that they had used years before. Is that true?
I don't know about that. See, I've never heard, well, there's a recording in English with Tolse, I think, which incorporates the Rathaus orchestration, which I haven't heard in many years. I have a recording of the 74 broadcast with Shippers, and some of what they did is they realigned, they used the Rimsky alignment of choral, of the choral writing in the prologue. In Mussorgsky, it's more quirky, which surprised me. And well, I really don't know about the Rathaus, how much of that was in there. Steve,
what is the story on the actual performance parts? If there are this many editions, obviously, either they were renting parts, or they had parts written for the particular presentation, or they had some circulating parts that were in one place, perhaps even the Fleischer collection. I don't know, I've never looked it up. And then went to other people to be used and touched up. When I was working at Leeds, which is 1961 maybe, we did not have a Boris set of performing parts. We did have the Lamb score, and we had a bound score, which I have a large miniature score, of which I have a copy, and I don't remember which edition it is. I've never had the occasion to use it. But I remember that it was in conflict with the Lamb, and I don't think it was purely Rimsky. Now, I also remember that the Lamb was part of an attempted complete edition.
Right.
Because I remember there was a revision for it that went with it. And this is just me being a stock clerk.
No, that'd be right.
But there's some, the basic question, what was really available for people who wanted to perform it, and could they perform it free using their own, since most of this period of time, the Russian material was not copyright, and did that have an effect on what you're talking about here in any significant way?
Of the recordings, you mean?
Of the recordings and of the performances as well, that may have been the underpinnings for those recordings.
Well, none of the original orchestration recordings, or I should say all of the original orchestration recordings post-dated the David Lloyd-Jones score. Uh-huh. So that's Oxford material that they're using for those scores. What they used before, of course, was the Rimsky, There were some recordings of the Shostakovich orchestration.
We didn't have the Shostakovich.
You didn't have the Shostakovich.
Well, I think
there's a recording on Berlin Classics with Teo Adam, one disc, but significant enough that you can get an idea of what the Shostakovich orchestration is like. And of course, it's Mussorgsky's notes, unaltered, but just the orchestration changed.
So it's still kind of limbo-ish.
Exactly, yeah. Well, limbo-ish for people who don't want to pay the...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But I don't remember there being an easy source for the performance parts that weren't Rimsky. Now, I do not remember...
For Rimsky?
Somebody may remember who's in the room whether there was a set of parts available for Kalmus by... There were quirky things in the Kalmus catalog. For example, they're the only ones who had, in the vocal score, the second edition of Butterfly. Mm-hmm. And so they had odd sources.
Right.
But this is sort of the business and mechanics part of what underlies what you're discussing.
Right.
And I wonder whether it's a part of the investigative process that it doesn't get a lot of attention, but might benefit from it.
Oh, thank you.